This is Focus 580, hour number two of the program. My name is David Inge. The producers, Harriet Williamson, Martha Deal, Henry Frain is at the controls. We're also happy to have here back on the program once again with us, Dr. Jeff Swearingen. He's a family practice physician at Carl Clinic in Urbana. Every other month, he's on the program on a Monday. And we built this into the schedule, a long time ago, because we thought that, in as much as from time to time we talk with specialists, and for example, the first hour today was a dermatologist, so we were doing skin stuff, but we thought maybe it would be a good idea to have someone who could respond to a wide range of questions, and that's certainly what he does in his practice. He sees people of all ages, grown-ups, kids, people who have a lot of different concerns, and so this is your chance to call in and ask questions. I try to remind people that always when there's a physician here that because the doctor can't see you, that's something of a limit on what we can do. But if you have questions, they are certainly welcome. And I know that the doctor will do his best to help you out. 333-9455 is the Champaign-Urbana number. And we do also have a toll-free line. Go to anywhere that you can hear us, and that's 800-222-9455. Well, thanks very much for being here.
Thank you, David. I'm glad to be back.
We already have someone ready to go, so we'll get right to them in Atlanta, Illinois, on our line number four, the toll-free line. Hello.
Good morning, and thank you very much for taking my call.
Sure.
This kind of question is in regards to my wife, and it involves the risk of CAT scans being used as a diagnostic tool. I'll give you a brief summary of the context of the question is that in the process of looking for an acid reflux problem, they did a CAT scan, and although that showed nothing in that area, it showed a problem with a little nodule about the size of an eraser on her lung. So there was another CAT scan to look at it, and then they did a biopsy on it, which involved several CAT scans to pull out three samples out of this little nodule, and it was benign. So they turned her over to a pulmonary specialist, and he decided that he would throw all that out the window. He didn't believe in biopsies, and so he just wanted to do a CAT scan every 3 months to see whether it was going to grow or not. And after a year and four more CAT scans, so that means seven, it hasn't grown, and she indicated to the doctor that she would like to make the interval a little bit greater. In effect, on PBS and other places, you know, this CAT scan radiation thing has become quite worrisome in the medical profession, and she did bring this up to him, and he agreed that it was worrisome, but he still wanted one every 3 months. So what is your opinion on CAT scans for diagnostics?
As with any medical test, there should be a good reason to do it, and if there isn't, then it shouldn't be done. CT scans, as compared to plain X-rays, can, in selected cases, provide a significant improvement in visualization. In the case of your wife's situation, in all likelihood, what's being followed is whether this nodule in the lung is becoming calcified or not. In many instances, most people in the Midwest, because of exposure to histoplasmosis, have a number of small calcifications in their lungs, and it's fairly typical and otherwise not worrisome. The problem occurs when you incidentally, like in your wife's case, they were looking for something else, but they did one of these, oh, by the way, we found this other thing, and you end up chasing it until you figure out whether this is a benign process or not. In instances where lung nodules are not calcified, the question becomes, is this a growth? And then you need to know, is it a benign or malignant growth? Or are you simply catching one of these very common calcified nodules before it has calcified? And the CT scan can help look at that area much closer than a plain X-ray. Now, you can certainly debate how frequently you need to look at that. If you have, say, a patient who has a tremendously strong history of tobacco use, then the suspicion that this new nodule might be cancerous would be much higher than somebody who says, you know, I've never smoked in my entire life. So you need to look at the clinical situation. it's fairly common if over the course of time there isn't anything suspicious about it, then in fact you do lengthen the amount of time between scans. In most instances, folks will say if it remains unchanged for 2 years, then it's probably a benign process. And in this particular case, your concerns about the amount of radiation exposure is quite valid. It needs to be contrasted with, well, if I didn't look at this thing at all, you know, what would happen to it? And in some instances, a nodule will be large enough that it can be seen with a plain X-ray. And if that's the case, then a regular X-ray, which involves significantly less radiation exposure, may be a perfectly reasonable way to follow it. There are concerns about the cumulative risk of radiation exposure with CT scans. And it's probably estimated at this point to be related to a very, very small percentage, probably no more than 1% of cancers that are discovered in the general population. But this is a particular concern for your wife's case, and I think it's very reasonable to discuss with the pulmonary physician in the context of her clinical situation what's the longest interval between examinations that he would consider to be reasonable.
I really appreciate your answer, and it's been, because of the radiation thing, it's been a big worry over the last year, and I really appreciate this. Thank you very much.
All right. You're welcome. Thanks for the call. I think we talked about this last time we talked or time before, that there had been this concern perhaps that doctors were being a little too free in using CAT scans. You don't want to give people the idea that it's a harmful procedure. It can be very useful, but I guess as you say, you just want to make sure that you have a real good reason for
right.
doing it.
And the degree of clarity that you get with the high resolution CT scans is so good that in fact people do like to use it, because in some instances lesser exams don't give you all of the information that you want. But in many instances, either following the clinical course or using other methods of investigation, plain X-rays sometimes give you enough information. Ultrasound doesn't involve any radiation. MRIs don't involve any radiation. And so there are other ways to potentially look at different parts of the anatomy. One of the problems that has come up recently, well, not so much recently, I guess, but since the advent of higher resolution CT scans, is a very common situation, just as this gentleman described about his wife. They were looking for something else, something related to, you know, abdominal problems, but they found this little nodule in her lung. Well, this is an incidental finding. In the medical literature, these are now referred to as incidentalomas, because they are so common. And they've actually looked at, basically, if you took 100 people and, you know, CT'd them, you'd find all sorts of little bumps and nodules and cysts and little tiny growths. And the real question becomes, what clinical significance do they have? And the answer is, 99 times out of 100, nothing. But now that you can see them, the question becomes, well, what should I do about that? In the past, we didn't have anything that allowed us to see them, so we didn't worry about them. But internally, all of us have, you know, little bumps and nodules and things that probably really don't have any medical significance. In rare instances, yes, you may in fact pick up something early that would be better treated, finding it earlier rather than later. But the flip side is how many people are we going to expose to large amounts of radiation to find that 1 in 100 case?
Okay. Well, other questions are certainly welcome. Our guest this morning is Dr. Jeff Swearingen. He's a family practice doctor at Carle Clinic. Every other month he's here on a Monday to take healthcare questions. Could be just about anything. Might be on your mind? 333-9455. And toll-free, 800-222-9455. I know one of the things that I wanted to ask you about recently, I guess at least within the last couple of months, the CDC put out a report that had to do with some of the vaccines that were available for adults, things that they felt would would have benefit, and that not enough adults were taking advantage of them. And as I recall, the things that they listed were some things that have been around for a long time, like vaccines for flu and pneumonia. But also, I believe that one of the things that they mentioned was the vaccine for the human papilloma virus. And another was the relatively new is the vaccine that we have now for shingles. And there were those four specifically that I remember in the stories. And there might be something else that you would want to put on the list.
There is. For adults, most folks know that every 10 years they're supposed to get their tetanus updated. And that's still something that is important to do. But the other recent recommendation has been for adults, when they're due for a tetanus booster, to also be immunized against pertussis, which is what commonly was referred to as whooping cough. This is typically a childhood illness, but in fact, adults gradually lose their immunity over time. And so there is now a recommendation for adults to be re-immunized to try and prevent especially small infants from becoming infected with pertussis. Infants get immunized at initially 2, 4, and 6 months of age, but they don't get their complete immunity until they complete the series. So there is a group of small infants that are susceptible to pertussis, and adults who have now lost their immunity become a reservoir for the illness. So in general, for adults needing a tetanus booster, they can also get a pertussis booster at the same time. It is packaged into one shot, so you don't get any more pokes than you would otherwise get. And that is one of the current recommendations for adult immunization. You mentioned flu and pneumonia. Those have been around for a long time. Mm-hmm. The flu shot recommendations have been expanded. Anybody over the age of 50, anybody with chronic diseases, pregnant women, and also children between the ages of 6 months and 5 years are recommended for flu. The pneumonia vaccination is generally given after the age of 65, or again to folks with underlying significant medical conditions. The HPV vaccination is called Gardasil and is intended for adolescent women and young adults who potentially are going to be exposed to HPV during sexual activity. Certain types of HPV virus have been strongly associated with the development of cervical cancer. So this becomes an opportunity, if you're vaccinated, to help prevent the possibility of the viral infections that can lead to cervical cancer.
The one thing that I wanted to particularly to talk about was the vaccine for shingles. And but maybe I'll tell you what, because we have a couple of callers, rather than make them wait, why don't we do them? And I want to come back.
We'll come back to that.
Kind of come back to that, because I'm particularly interested in what sort of recommendation is about who should get it. We'll talk with someone here, however, in Muhammad, line number one. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
Well, it just so happens that it's exactly what I was going to ask about, the shingles vaccine. And I also want to know if a person, say, over 58 is my age, should I get the Gardasil? And just talk about those two, please. And maybe even polio. Do we still need polio vaccine updates? Thank you.
You're welcome. We'll start with the shingles vaccination. The shingles vaccination is actually not terribly new. Mm-hmm. What is new is the recommendation to use it in adults. Shingles is the reactivation of the chickenpox virus. When you get chickenpox, usually as a child, the illness itself runs its course, but the virus takes up residence in our spinal column in some of the nerve fibers. Now, if it just sits there quietly for the rest of your life, it causes no problems whatsoever. But as you get older, or in any situation where your immunity starts to wane, the virus can become reactivated, and typically it will travel out that nerve root. And so most people, when they get shingles, have a very painful, because it's involving the nerve, and it usually runs from the middle of the spine in the back around to the middle of the front, typically most commonly in the trunk, but it can occur in the head and neck and in other parts of the body as well. So it was theorized that if we could boost our immunity again against the chickenpox virus, we might be able to prevent shingles from reoccurring. And in fact, with the vaccination, the risk of shingles goes down by about 50%. Because most cases are associated with advancing age, the current recommendation is for folks 60 and above to be offered the opportunity to get that particular vaccination. Because it's new, some insurance companies have been saying, well, maybe we'll cover it, maybe we won't. Mm-hmm. My estimation is that probably within the next year or two, it will become a standard part of medical care and consequently will probably be routinely covered. But for folks who want to get the vaccination, I've been telling them, you know, double check with your insurance company and make sure that that's a covered thing, or at least know that you're going to get the bill for it if it's not. Okay. But it is a quite reasonable vaccination. And because it is related to the other chickenpox virus, we know that it's been around for a long time and is very safe and effective.
Mm-hmm. I tell you what, why don't we also come back to, I have somebody on a cell phone I'd like to try to get to. Well, let's come back to Gardasil. Let's do the cell phone call, though, here next on our line number two. Hello.
Hi, how are you doing today?
Good.
Okay. I was calling, I was wondering if the doctor could talk about the additives that are added to vaccines, such as the mercury in the flu shot and other things, preservatives or what have you, that are, you know, they're considering are dangerous now, but they're still there.
Actually, they've been removed.
Okay, so the mercury isn't in the flu shot any longer?
No, what was referred to as thimerosal, it was a mercury derivative used as a preservative, and those have been removed from vaccinations, especially since in the past there was some concern that the mercury used in children's vaccinations was somehow associated with the risk of autism. That was very, very closely looked at in several recent studies, and there was no relationship to that. But because of the concern, the manufacturers have eliminated mercury from the vaccinations.
Okay, so, and there aren't any other additives that are a concern at this time?
The only other concern, really, say for influenza, is somebody with a significant egg allergy, because the virus is, in fact, cultured in eggs, and protein related to that can potentially activate an allergic reaction in susceptible individuals.
Okay, thank you.
Thanks. And I'm glad the caller raised the issue, because this is the kind of thing that I think there has been a lot of concern. A lot of parents have been concerned about this, and particularly there in some people's minds, there was this concern that there might be some link between the mercury preservative in childhood vaccines and autism.
Right.
And that now there have been some recent studies, and in fact, if I'm remembering this right now, the mercury has been gone now for something like 7 years,
right.
Maybe it was 2001, right. And recent studies have shown, you would think if there was some relationship, that the incidence of autism would have gone down,
right.
And not only has it not gone down, it's actually gone up.
Right, and the other concern related to the measles, mumps, and rubella immunization, the MMR, and the problem there is that the time at which it's autism is either suspected or diagnosed simply chronologically corresponds with when they got that immunization. And you're correct. If there was some direct tie between the quote additives in there, if those were removed, then you should have seen a lower incidence.
Yeah.
Autism, I think, is been spotlighted recently. People are more aware of it, and the diagnosis of it is more frequent, but I think that's because people are specifically looking for it. In the past, kids got labeled with other diagnoses, and the definition of autism has been sort of expanded to include milder forms, and consequently, the numbers have, in fact, increased. Whether there's something else triggering the increased incidence at this time really isn't known.
Let's talk with someone in Champaign next. This is line number three. Hello.
Hello.
Mm-hmm.
I understand there are so many years between having a pneumonia shot. Could you give me that time, whether it's 4 or 5 or what?
For most individuals who don't have any chronic underlying medical problems or especially lung-related problems, a single pneumonia vaccination after the age of 65 is considered adequate. Someone who has significant other medical conditions, especially pulmonary conditions, repeating their pneumonia vaccination in 10 years is a reasonable thing to do.
All right. Thank you.
All right. Thank you. Well, I want to come back to the Gardasil, the vaccine for the HPV, the human papillomavirus, because as you explained, this is something that if you can prevent young women from contracting the virus, then we expect that we'll be putting a good dent in cervical cancer. That doesn't mean we're going to get rid of cervical cancer, but
right. And one very, very important point is that the Gardasil vaccination is not a substitute for getting a regular pap smear. And some folks have sort of said, well, gee, you know, if I'm protected against that, I won't get cervical cancer, and why do I need a pap smear? Well, in fact, the reduction of HPV probably takes care of, it's estimated, 70% of cervical cancer. Well, that's not all of them, and there isn't any way to know without a pap smear whether a particular cervix is healthy or not. Mm-hmm. Now, there are probably a dozen or more HPV strains. And in most young women, if they're exposed to the non-cancer types of HPV, they usually have it in their system for a period of time, and then the body's immune system usually takes care of it. So for many women, the more benign forms of HPV come, are there, go away, don't generally cause any problem. But the particular strains that are associated with tend to persist, and those are the ones that then lead to an abnormal pap smear. The usual progression of cervical cancer is usually quite slow. It's not something that occurs in weeks or months, but in most instances takes years to develop. And that's why the pap smear is so effective, is that in many instances you can pick up an abnormality early in the process. And then there are a number of very good treatments for the early stages of cervical cancer. It's when it's discovered late that you run into the real problem.
Yeah. Well, the question I think now confronting older women who have been sexually active for a while, since what we're doing is we're recommending that girls have this before they become sexually active. So then the question is, so if you're 20, 30, 40, 50, 60, What do you think about that for women at those various ages? Is it recommended that they also get it?
Not necessarily. And the studies were not done in that population, so we don't have any definitive information about that. Certainly, a woman who has consistently had normal pap smears is in a monogamous relationship probably doesn't need to worry about it. And if that's not the case, then it's still very important to get those regular pap smears, but it would be in a decision made on a case-by-case basis depending on her activity.
Okay. We're at our midpoint here. Our guest is Dr. Jeff Swearingen. He's a family practice physician at Carl Clinic in Urbana, and every other month on a Monday he's here, and we do this show. We call Talk to the Family Doctor, and if you have a question, you can call us 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. Just for a second to go back to shingles. Have we been giving the chickenpox vaccine long enough so that one could answer this question? If you were vaccinated against chickenpox, never had the disease, what is the likelihood that as an adult you would get shingles?
You can still get shingles. In general, folks who have been vaccinated have milder cases if they get it. But it does not eliminate the entire possibility.
Okay, so even if you're in this population group, that you got the chickenpox vaccine. Mm-hmm. It is still possible you get shingles.
Yes.
And then you're saying now, and the general recommendation is for other people, if you had anybody who had chickenpox, there's the possibility you get shingles. So now when you turn 60,
that's simply the fact that as individuals get older, their immunity tends to wane. And that seems to be what allows the chickenpox virus to reactivate and then produce the clinical syndrome of shingles. But other individuals who have problems with their immunity, in particular, say, folks who've had chemotherapy for their cancer, have mm-hmm. lowered immunity because of the medications used to treat a number of cancers. Folks who are on chronic steroid use for a variety of medical conditions may indeed have lowered immunity. So in those particular situations, it's quite reasonable for those individuals to talk to their physician about getting the vaccination at an earlier age.
And I guess I have known people who had attacks of shingles who were under 50.
Oh, yes. And so we've seen it in children and adolescents and young adults. It's just not statistically as common as it is above the age of 60.
Mm-hmm. Well, we have some other callers here. Our next is someone in Piatt County on our toll-free line, line 4. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
Yes. I finished chemo myself a year ago in October, and now my friend is organizing a blood drive in our small town. And so I was wondering, are there restrictions on giving blood after chemo, or is there a time period? Or, I mean, you spoke about immunity, but I was just wondering if I can give blood.
If in fact, your blood count is normal
mm-hmm.
now, I'm not aware of any reason why you couldn't.
Okay, because my last blood count was fine, so I can do that.
Excellent.
Good.
Okay.
Very good.
Thanks so much.
Well, we continue. We'll talk to our next caller here, somebody in Peoria on our line 1. Hello.
Yes. I'm calling again about the shingles vaccine. Can someone who has had shingles
get it again?
Get
yes.
It again. They
yes.
can.
Yes, they can. It's not terribly common. It's not very typical for folks to have more than one outbreak of shingles, but yes, it can occur.
It can.
Yes.
Well, I'm 71, and I had about 15 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
So
it would still be a reasonable thing to consider vaccination.
Okay. Okay, thank you.
Thanks. Mm-hmm. I suppose if there is, now there is, of course, the exception, but I suppose if there is any good news about shingles, chances are if you have it once, you're not going to have it again.
It's very unusual to have that. But again, in an individual who has a significant decrease in their own immunity for whatever reason, whether it's just age-related or some other medical condition, it can, in fact, reactivate.
Mm-hmm.
It does not go away.
Is your chances of having it better if you've had it once than if you've never had it?
That I don't know.
Yeah, okay.
One of the major reasons to try and prevent shingles, one, the initial outbreak itself is generally pretty uncomfortable.
Yeah.
But in the majority of cases, it goes away after a number of weeks. And most folks who have shingles say, yeah, it was, miserably uncomfortable for a number of weeks, but then it went away and I feel fine. There is a proportion of folks who get shingles who, even after the rash, which kind of looks like chickenpox, goes away, they continue to have pain in the nerve. And this is referred to as postherpetic neuralgia. That can go on for months or years and can be really, really uncomfortable. Nerve pain is one of the most uncomfortable types of pain to get. And if you can prevent the postherpetic neuralgia by preventing the outbreak of shingles, you've done somebody a big favor. Mm.
And what do you do for somebody who has shingles?
In most instances, antiviral medications and pain pills, basically. In some instances, the use of cortisone-type medications to suppress inflammation on a short-term basis is also used.
Mm-hmm.
If somebody develops postherpetic neuralgia, then you're usually talking about pain medications or specific types of medication that target the nerve to reduce those painful impulses. But, again, you're talking about sort of long-term treatment there.
Mm-hmm. Next, we will talk with someone in Champaign. Line two. Hello.
Hello.
Yes, hi.
I am interested or want some information about reflux disease. And the reason I'm calling is because of a few years back, probably about 8 or 10 years ago, I had a pretty bad bout of it. And it and they treated it with Nexium because they said my esophagus had been, I guess, worn down or something. So I have not had issues at all ever since then until about a month ago. And it's kind of the same symptoms I had before. Is it possible just to get something now that's over the counter to treat that? Because I kind of know what it is. Or do you think it's a better idea just to go back and see a gast? And the other reason I'm calling is because to see a gastro in this town is not an easy task. And so I was wondering, is there anything else that might be possible to treat it? Because it's exactly the same symptoms I had before. And so I'm just wondering if I can't do that in another way.
Well, let me ask you a couple of questions.
Okay.
Were you aware of anything with your first episode that seemed to precipitate it?
Well, they did find, when they had to go in, they did an endoscopy.
Right.
Is that what it was called? Okay. And they did find, that's where they found that the lining was pretty bad shape. And then what they also found, because they went a little further, was that I did have an ulcer. And so, but I'm not having those symptoms, like, because that was like stomach ache and pain and just general not feeling good with the digestive system. So I'm not having that. It's just the feeling I always had was always in my throat, like a, when you eat tortilla chips and you get one stuck in there or something, that's kind of like it's a constant, like I've got a constant chip stuck in my throat.
Okay. At the time that your ulcer was diagnosed, you mentioned that you were placed on Nexium.
Yes.
Did you have any additional treatment?
Well, yeah. The for the ulcer, they gave me like a, I had to be on antibiotics forever, it seemed like.
Okay. You were probably treated for a bacterial organism called H. pylori.
Yeah, that sounds familiar.
Okay.
Yeah.
That is a bacteria that resides in the lining of the stomach.
Okay.
And has, in fact, been shown to be related to the development of ulcer disease. The concern that I would have for you is that this may be recurrent.
Oh, even if I'm not having any, like, stomach problems themselves?
Yet.
Oh.
Right. So I think I think it would be very reasonable to be checked for the presence of H. pylori again, because you've had it once, and, and treating it once does not prevent you from getting it again.
I see.
And
okay.
The Nexium-type medications are used primarily just to suppress acid production. And there is a medication similar to it that is available over-the-counter.
Okay.
And it's called Prilosec OTC, and the OTC stands for over-the-counter.
Right.
But it's in the same general class of medication as the Nexium. And for individuals who don't have any other problem other than a little acid getting up from their stomach into their esophagus, that's a very reasonable choice to suppress that acid.
Okay.
Now, the additional concern is that in some individuals, the constant exposure of acid from their stomach up into the esophagus does indeed cause more than irritation.
Mm-hmm.
And in those particular settings, if it looks pretty abnormal, they will go ahead and biopsy the farthest point of the esophagus, looking for a condition referred to as Barrett's esophagus.
Hmm.
Barrett's is thought to be a precancerous condition, and as such is something that is usually then monitored by the gastroenterologist with periodic endoscopy.
I see. So, I guess I didn't have that issue because they didn't really, I don't recall the name, and then I also, they never really said to come back and see them again.
Okay.
So I didn't have any follow-ups that I had to do with them.
Okay. At the very least, I would suggest that your regular physician order the test to check for H. pylori again.
Okay, so that's a pretty simple thing to do. I don't have to get knocked out or
no.
anything. Okay, good.
No, not at all.
Now, you understand the issue with getting an appointment with a gastro.
Oh, yes.
because I'm not, where I was treated was in another state and all that previously, and I just moved here about 5 years ago. So I did try and call just to see if I could get an appointment to get in, and I had to get referrals, and I don't know what else, and they don't just see you if you, you know. So, and then even somebody who did have an appointment, it was like in April.
Mm-hmm.
So if I take this Prilosec OTC mm-hmm. and the symptoms go away, that should be okay. But maybe still just try and follow up with my primary physician or something to do the H. pylori test.
Yes.
Okay, so that might be a way to go.
Yes.
Great.
Perfectly reasonable.
Okay, wonderful. Well, thanks for your help.
All right. Well, thank you. And let's see. We'll talk with somebody else here. Next caller is in Gibson City on line number 4. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
I had a pacemaker put in July 30th, and right after that I developed this, what I thought was just a rash down my chest, and I talked to the doctor, and he didn't seem concerned about it. He said, well, I never saw it down that far, and I found out that they treat it with Benadine, I think it is. They didn't tell me, but I found out that's what it was causing it. And so it all broke out, and I finally went to a dermatologist, and he didn't tell me what it was either, but it is a radiation burn is what it is. What do you got to say about that?
Had you had previous radiation treatment for something?
No, but Benadine, I think that's the right word. It's got stuff in it that, I don't know, isotopes or anything. It's got radiation in it.
If I'm understanding you, Betadine is an iodine-containing antiseptic soap. Is that what we're referring to?
Well, that's what you, that's what I, yeah, but...
There is no radiation in Betadine.
Isn't?
No. Now, people can develop irritation and sometimes an allergic reaction to iodine-containing substances, but it has nothing to do with radiation.
Well, finally I went to a dermatologist, and he says, well, you won't... I've got FINACEA, $100 a crack for a small tube, and... I've had it about 2 weeks now, and it's finally the color's getting a little bit different, but he's told me don't expect it to go away right away. But you think it's just soap in that stuff, huh?
The iodine in the Betadine soap can, for certain individuals, cause either irritation or sometimes an allergic rash. But the usual treatment for that is to simply avoid any skin contact with iodine-containing compounds, and then usually some type of cortisone cream or ointment is used to settle down the irritation.
So you think it'll go away then?
If it's related to the exposure and you don't have any additional exposure, yes, it should.
Okay, thank you.
Mm-hmm. We have about 10 minutes left in this part of Focus 580 with Dr. Jeff Swearingen. He's a family practice doctor at Carl Clinic in Urbana. Every other month he's here on the program, and we just give you the chance to call in and ask general healthcare questions. As I always say, that he sees people of all ages in the practice. He sees grown-ups, he sees kids, and he sees people who have a wide range of health concerns. So if you have a question, I know he'll do his best to help you out.
That last caller should have called an hour earlier.
Should have called to talk to the dermatologist. Well, at any rate, questions welcome, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. How's the flu season been going this year? I guess I haven't really read that much about flu.
It's really, I hate to say this out loud before we're done with the winter, but it's really been pretty mild. And that's, I think, perhaps due to the fact that people are certainly much more aware of the benefits of influenza vaccination and the fact that there wasn't any shortage of the flu vaccine this year. Mm-hmm. So I think a lot more people had the opportunity to get immunized, and that makes a big difference.
Is there are still most people getting the vaccine where it requires a stick, that it is an injection and as opposed to some, you know, a different way of doing it?
Well, the other form is a nasal spray, and for whatever reason, most people just don't enjoy sticking something up their nose. It's actually more expensive than the flu vaccine, so I think the vast majority of people basically go with the regular shot.
So it has no particular advantage other than if you just rather not get stuck. You're going to get stuck somehow, whether it's something sticking in your nose or they're sticking in your shoulder. Okay. Well, we have some other callers here. We'll try to get in as many as we can in the time we have. Line one is the first in line right here. Hello.
Good morning.
Yes.
I was listening a little bit ago when the lady called, I think from Peoria, about giving blood after chemo. And after I had radiation, they said I'd have to wait 5 years, and that if I had chemo, I would never be able to give blood again. And I checked that with both the Red Cross and the blood services there on University in Champaign. So I hope that changed, but I don't think it has.
I am not aware of medically why that would be the case, unless there's something specifically abnormal about the blood still.
They didn't know anything about my cases. I stopped there and talked to the blood services, thinking they might be different than the Red Cross, but it was what I was told by both groups. 5 years after radiation and never after chemo. I hope that's wrong.
I'm not aware that that's correct, except perhaps the situation where somebody has had a blood-related malignancy. If they had leukemia, that might be, you know, a cause for concern.
Mine was a cancerous tumor, and they didn't even know the details of it. I just said, I've had radiation. How soon can I get blood? And both of them told me 5 years. So maybe somebody from the blood services or Red Cross could clarify that more. But just wanted to call in and share that piece of information.
Well, I'll be happy to check into that a little further, and if we can get some additional information, pass that along.
As they say, it'd be wonderful if I was wrong, but I don't think I am. But thank you.
Oh, okay. Well, maybe there's somebody who can... I'm here on the website of the Red Cross, and I'm looking at that. Maybe I can come up with something here. In the meantime, let's go to another caller, and this would be Champaign and line number two. Hello?
Hello?
Yes.
I'm going back to the shingle question. I had the shingles in my 50s. I had the wonderful 60th birthday this year, and I was told by my physician that I should indeed get the vaccination. But my question was, what is the research on people who have had shingles and then get the shingle vaccination?
There's no harm in getting the shingles vaccination, even if you've had shingles before. As we mentioned earlier, it's not common for people to get shingles on multiple occasions, but there isn't anything that says that if you've had shingles once, you can't get it again. So it's still considered reasonable for folks over the age of 60 to go ahead and be vaccinated, because it will, in fact, statistically reduce the likelihood of having it again.
I didn't know if there maybe had been, if you've had a disease and then you have a vaccination against it, some kind of reaction?
No, that's not been the case.
All right. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Well, now, here I am on the website of the Red Cross, and here's what it says about cancer and giving blood. It says, eligibility depends on the type of cancer and the treatment history. If you had leukemia or lymphoma, including Hodgkin's disease and other cancers of the blood,
right,
you are not eligible to donate. Other types of cancer are acceptable if the cancer has been treated successfully and it's been at least 5 years since treatment was completed and there has been no cancer recurrence in this time. It also says some low-risk cancers, including squamous or basal cell cancers of the skin, do not require a 5-year waiting period.
Those last two are common skin cancers that very rarely ever get into the blood supply and metastasize, and that's why there is essentially no restriction against those.
Okay, so the bottom line is here, it depends, and it depends on what kind of cancer. It depends on what kind of cancer it was.
Right.
All right. Well, again, I hope that helps. Obviously, you want to talk wherever it is you give blood. You want to go down there, ask them, you know, and see what they say.
And the other thing about the blood supply, we frequently get folks in the office who, you know, have gotten a letter from the blood bank, Red Cross, that says, you know, you've been deferred. You know, we're not accepting your blood. And in many instances, it's a very, very minor issue that really ultimately doesn't have any clinical significance. But because the blood banks themselves are really hyper-vigilant about the potential for transmitting any type of illness, you know, to the recipient of that blood, they have very, very stringent requirements on what, you know, blood they will accept. And I've had the experience many, many times where somebody's had a very minor abnormality that ultimately is clinically shown to be, you know, not significant, and the blood bank still won't take their blood. So they're really very, very picky about what they'll take.
All right. Next caller is in Urbana, and this is line number Potomac, line number three. That's going to be the next person. Hello. Yes.
Hello. Well, I'm very glad you got onto that website, because I was just going to tell you about the I was treated with the chemotherapy, and now they're after me. It's been 8 years, and I get regular calls from the blood bank. But anyway, my question is your attitude as a doctor when you get a patient. I was thinking about this woman who was getting the CAT scans. Could she put her foot down and just say, you know, no?
Sure.
And what would the doctor would some doctors might get really miffed at that and throw her out and say, go find somebody else? Or
that's very true, but not all would. You know, most of these decisions aren't, you know, totally black and white. They're not, you know, if you don't do this, you'll die kind of decisions. I think it's perfectly reasonable for patients to discuss with their physicians the pros and cons, the advantages, the disadvantages, the potential risks of doing something versus the potential risks of not doing something. And then ultimately, the patient needs to make a decision for themselves. The physician should be there to provide the relevant information to help make that decision. But in the long run, ultimately, it's the patient's decision as to what they do or don't want to do with their own body and their own health. In many instances, we give advice based on our knowledge and experience, but that doesn't mean, you know, it's carved in stone.
Yes, I mean, I'm just aware of a couple of situations, you know, as I get older, I'm getting in my 60s and stuff, where people just go along with the doctor thinking they're always right and giving them the correct information, and sometimes it turns out that it's not, you know, if the patient had said something like, you know, I understand the risk, and I think that, you know, I'll go along with this condition and leave it be, it would have been better off. Because when the surgery was done or whatever procedure was done, it was detrimental. So you hate to get into an argument with a doctor,
right.
But you know, I guess as you say, some doctors will react a lot differently than others, and being a reasonable accepting a decision by a patient that's contrary.
Right, and that's more of a personality issue than anything else. And I think patients need to find physicians that they're, you know, comfortable with. Some patients don't want to have a discussion. They just say, you know, tell me what it is that you think I need to do, and I'll do it. Mm-hmm. And they don't want to think about it. They're going to rely on, you know, quote, expert opinion to determine the best course. At the other end of the spectrum, there are folks who say, you know, show me the studies that say that this does or doesn't work.
In detail. Right?
In detail, exactly. You know, you can get on the internet now and find anything you want that supports, you know, one position versus another. And ideally, the physician should be there to help you sort through all of that information and find out what's relevant and correct and applicable to your situation. And sometimes, you know, there are areas where there isn't a black and white answer, that, you know, it really is gray. And
right.
There are a number of things that, you know, just aren't known, or at least not yet.
Right.
And so there's always going to be some degree of uncertainty and ambiguity, and people need to decide for themselves what they're comfortable with.
Right, and what they're willing to undergo and suffer, you know, medically, if they want to do something and cooperate with the doctor and try to get a handle on something. But then again, they might say, you know what? What's the point? You know, I'm just going to hurt myself, and why do I want to do that? So
mm-hmm.
Anyway, I'd better let other people talk. I heard there was more behind me, so. Thank you.
You're welcome.
Thank you. I think we do have some other callers, but I'm not sure that we really have time. I think if I did, I would run the risk of running long. So I'm afraid I'm going to have to say I'm sorry to the callers. We can't take you. But Dr. Jeff will be back again in 2 months. And, you know, perhaps in the meantime, there are some other things that we might be – other health topic we might be doing on the program. But for right now, I think we're going to have to leave it at that. Any last thought that you'd like to leave with folks?
Stay warm.
All right. Our guest is Dr. Jeff Swearingen. He's a family practice physician at Carl Clinic in Urbana. He's here every other month, always on a Monday, to take questions. Thanks.
Thank you, David.